you have heard this week several presentations on governance and management, and you have had a number of questions. So I think it's appropriate we take this next 50 minutes and discuss that topic a little further. Dr. Andreasen, in his plenary session, gave us a few practical examples of the line between governance and management. Dr. Andreasen, as we begin, perhaps you could review with us briefly the difference or where you see the line between governance and management.
Yeah, let me try to speak to that again briefly. And the point, I think the driver in all of that, Bob, is that these two are separate functions in an institution. And when they get mixed up, we tend to be malfunctioning. So what is the difference? Let me start with the part that we know the best, and that's management. Management is, by that we mean that the people who are being put in charge of leading the institution or organization, but we are talking about healthcare, mostly institutions, so management would be people like Leon sitting to the right. I'm working in education, so I would represent management in education. We are responsible for the work, the mission, the service, the financial operations, the staff, the effectiveness of this organization, and we do it day in and day out. That's our day job, and that's what management does. But where does management come from? They don't come from themselves. In fact, I have a little beef with some language we use even in here. We sometimes say, and some of my colleagues in higher education are saying, my faculty, my deans. I'm sorry to say it, but sir, these are not your faculty. You're the administration, you're management. We shouldn't use language like that. It makes me cringe when I hear it in educational meetings. It's bad manners, and unfortunately, if we speak badly about each other, we tend to think badly about each other as well, and then we treat each other badly. So it's good to keep the language clear. So now we know what management is. They operate the institution. But where does management come from? Management is assigned to do its management work by a group of people representing governance. We call them generally the board members. All right? They appoint management for a term and assign management to look after the institution that is, in a sense, owned by a public group of people who have designated a board to appoint management to look after the institution. The board is not on site all the time. They come two or three times a year to look after management to see that it does a good job. And if it doesn't do a good job, you know, the board can fire management and appoint somebody else. That's the board's privilege. And some of you feel that the board should never do that. Well, it's their job to appoint management, to evaluate management, and from time to time to replace management. And it happens, actually. I know. It can happen. And that's not a bad thing to discover. It gives you a dose of reality. And if you haven't been fired ever from a job, you know, that's maybe a deficit in your experience. I interviewed a member of the management team at Andrews University not so long ago. I'm trying to be serious about something lighthearted. And I interviewed this gentleman, and we talked about his experience and whether he would be a good member of our management team. And the first thing he said is, I wanted to know, I've been fired once. I said, well, that's okay. Tell me how that happened. And he told me how it happened. And I said, well, that's okay. It's not a problem. So we have management that looks after the day-to-day operations, and management is appointed by a board of trustees or a board of governors. They represent governance. And where does the board come from? Those people who blow in and out two or three times a year in the institution and check up on management. I'm sorry. They fly in and out. I work in an educational institution, and we have a way in higher education to laugh at ourselves.
That's right.
And laugh at things once in a while, and sometimes it's refreshing to do that. So on a university campus, management is there living on the top floor telling us what to do, and the governance people, these are the board members, are the people in the black suits who come three times a year, and we feed them a big dinner and ask them to vote certain things, which they usually do. But seriously, the board appoints management, and they are charged with looking after the long-term welfare of the institution. And who appoints the board? See, everyone has a supervisor, and the board members sometimes think that they have all power, but they don't. The board members are also appointed. And who appoints the board members? Well, the board members are appointed by the owners of the corporation, the owners of the institution. There are many owners. In Adventist institution, you could say all the Adventists, all the people living around the community and so on, owns this place. It isn't owned by an officer in the church. It's owned by the constituents or the corporate members, the stakeholders. These people own the institution, they love it, and they appoint a board to keep an eye on it. And the board cannot keep an eye on it every day, so they appoint management to look after it every day. Three levels: the owners, stakeholders, the corporate members. They own the place. It's theirs. They're the only ones really who can sell it, if it comes down to it. They can't be there all the time. They meet every few years, and they appoint the board to keep an eye on it and govern it. Govern is the word. And to make sure that goes efficiently, the board appoints management to look after it from day to day. And I know there are tensions, and I think Pastor Cooper is going to talk about the tensions between them. Tensions are not bad, they're sort of wholesome, and we shouldn't be frightened at it, but sometimes we even should be a little lighthearted about these tensions because it makes it work easier. Tell us about the tensions. Is that what's coming
next?
Yes,
thank you.
That's what I thought.
thank you for that reminder. And you used the word tensions. Earlier in a presentation, Elder Cooper, you talked about the creep. Would you talk about some of the challenges with the creep between management and governance?
Sure. Thanks for a very creative way of dealing with what could otherwise be a very serious or a very boring discussion. What you've said is very insightful. I talked the other day about the creep of management agenda into the governance function. It's generally a one-way creep. You don't find very often that governance issues creep towards management. The tendency is the other way. And I'll explain, at least out of my experience, how I see this can easily happen. Let's say that the board appoints a new head of an organization. And in the course of the new head of the organization encountering the dimensions of his or her responsibility, he or she comes upon something that not sure if this is in the president's role of decision making. And if the governance documents do not define, I think it's important that governance documents define the role of the board and the role of the president. That is very helpful when there's at least some definition there. But we have a case here where a new administrator is not sure about a particular thing, and so that item comes to the board. The tendency of the board is not to look at whether or not this is a governance or management issue. The tendency of the board will be to solve the question and thereby create a precedent for what gets on the agenda in the future. That kind of thing, I think it's the role of the chair more than anyone else to be alert to that kind of thing, because that is the creep, that you move from what would be an administrative managerial decision ends up becoming a governance function. It's easy to do that because managerial decisions deal, they're more concrete, they deal with the more immediate. The governance functions are more nebulous because they deal with the future. That's difficult stuff. And it's very easy to say, I want to grab on to a decision that I can make today. I think it's important, particularly for this group, because as I mentioned again the other day, there are a number of us that move between institutional life and church life, and our structure of governance and management is different. I mentioned just a couple of things that were different about it the other day. I want to elaborate on that. In an institution, we have a board of directors that appoints a head of the institution. The head of the institution is given management authority. There is a lot of authority that is given to the head of the institution. In the church structure, we have an executive committee that elects a group of officers. Interestingly, the exercise of authority in the church structure is different than the exercise of authority in an institution. The head of the church structure, the president, has a lot of influential power, but independent decision making is more limited than in an institution. And those of us who move back and forth across this difference can end up working with an institutional governance structure that borrows some of its ideas from church structure that has more management issues in the governance. I think it's just important that we realize that difference and recognize it and respect it. I think it is very important.
One of the formative career moments in my life was a board meeting where I asked the board for a decision, and one of the laymen on my board said, if you want advice, I'll be happy to give it. But I'm not making a decision. That's your job. And so I'm thankful for some of those board members who knew and kept in mind and reminded me and the group of that line.
You know, maybe I should add, once in a while, you've got to watch about the other kind of a thing happening too, that an administrator, perhaps it's dealing with a whole new dimension of the life of an organization. You need to be careful that an administrator also respects the right of the board and the obligation of the board to make certain kinds of decisions. And again, I think it's the chair of the board that has to be alert to those kinds of issues.
Absolutely. Leon, do you have examples from your organization that help illustrate those points?
Yeah, look, having worked now for 8 years as the chief executive officer of a church institution, and having been part of, I guess, of a transition in management style, which has been sanctioned by the board and, in fact, I believe encouraged and supported by the board, I just want to make a couple of points. I think, you know, I like to express things in very simple terms. I was given the very daunting task of responding to Dr. Andreessen the other day from an excellent presentation, as you could imagine. All I can do, I guess, is try and distill that. But that, I feel, is something that I'm very passionate about, to distill things into very simple terms. You know, a board, clearly we've described the role of the board, but we have a tendency within the church to have a significant amount of representational board members. Mm-hmm. I believe we have in the past had too many. I think boards are moving towards more of a group of people who have something to offer, which is specifically theirs. And talked about that in the session on the board, and I think that was clarified. We moved in that direction from a board of 25 people. That's extraordinary when you think about it in retrospect, most of whom were representational, most of whom came across the road, who really only ever said anything when there was something to do with cars. and car policies. But most of the time had not much to offer, quite frankly. But down to a board now which is fluctuates between 11 and 13, and I think that's a great number. And we have a very active and supportive board now. And as CEO, I appreciate that enormously because they can be tremendously supportive of our CEO. Now, I think communication needs to be very clear. And the lines of communication that we've set up are simply between the chairman of the board and the CEO. And board members have a role, but which is very important, but communication needs to be very clear between the board and management. And I think that relationship between the board, CEO and the chairman is a really important one. And the functionality of the institution and the board very much depends on that relationship being one which is one of mutual respect and understanding and significant amount of communication so that that understanding is then transmitted to the board and by the CEO to the executive.
Let me follow up a little bit on what you said, because you said you went from a board of a small congregation, 25, down to a board of a dozen. When you did that, I assumed that not only did the numbers change, but the function and the relationship changed at the same time. When I travel around the world and make suggestions on governance and management, so often I'm met with the response that, well, that isn't the way we do it here. That's not our culture. That's not our tradition. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think we should be sensitive to traditions and cultures, and I think that's some place that we often go wrong. But there are some basic underlying principles which I think are common to all boards and institutions, which I think are quite clear.
Dr. Andreessen, do you want to add to that cultural?
Well, I thought about it a bit overnight because some of you asked the question yesterday when we spoke about organizational structure. You said where I live, some of you said our culture, our local practice makes these governance and management principles very difficult. And I said to myself afterwards, yes, I think that's right. We ought to listen to that. But then I would like to add by saying that these principles we talked about here for good governance and good management practices, these principles are challenged, I think, in all cultures. You know, we just heard from somebody saying that the government of a certain country in Europe, not all that far from here, is full of corrupt people. I don't know if that's true, but it may well be. Not so long ago, the President of the United States fired the President of General Motors. That's an unusual thing to do, and I think probably that was a mistake to do it that way. And that happened in that big country. And then we heard last week that the generals in the country, was it Honduras, fired the President and sent him packing, and everybody in the world is upset about that kind of government procedure. So I think you find malpractice in governance, in management, everywhere. It's just a matter of degrees and also sophistication with which we make our mistakes. And the point I'd like to make is that if we, as Christian managers, have discovered by talking together through careful study, even applying some biblical principles, if we have discovered good management and good governance principles, we should practice those and be an example as best we can, recognizing that we will fail from time to time, but we should have an ideal about good management and practice it in whatever culture, whatever country we are located, as a matter of Christian witness. I thought afterwards that we really should do that. And I would say if a board somewhere decides one afternoon to get rid of the board chair, I think we had a case somewhat like that yesterday, without following established bylaws or standard procedures, we should figure out a way to correct that. There are ways to change a board chair. Board chairs are normally selected, appointed by the board members themselves, depending on what the bylaws say, but typically that's being done. At the first board meeting, someone convenes the board, and a chair, a vice chair, and other board officers are appointed. And once we've established a pattern like that, no matter what happens in government in the country or in corporations in the country, we should not follow that pattern. We should say to ourselves, we are Christians. We want to do the best practice in our governance and strive for that rather than excusing bad practice because it's so common in our country or our region. I think that would be a good thing, a good witness that we could give. I know it's hard, but believe you me, it's difficult in Detroit as well. I live nearby, and I read about it all the time, and governance in Detroit is a big mess. It's not something that happens in Honduras. It happens around us. So Christians should stand out and practice good governance.
Yeah, Lowell?
I certainly agree. I think that what we need to keep in mind is that an individual can make of himself or herself a martyr very quickly by trumpeting the need for change and insisting on change. We part of our Adventist culture is that we do things together. And it's very important for someone who sees a need for change to be able to articulate a very convincing argument for that, and then to work with people in groups towards that kind of an end. We, too, have reduced the size of our boards at Loma Linda. We did it in a constituency meeting. And we brought a case before the constituency about the need to reduce the size of the board. It wasn't a big issue. I think the arguments were sound. We're certainly not down to the size of 13 as yet, but it was an important step in the direction. We created a grid of the kind of expertise that needs to be reflected on the board. That was agreed to by the constituency, that when we populate the board, we do so by looking at this grid of expertise that must be there. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that if we can make a clear case, people will often accept that. And sometimes when we feel that we're culturally bound to certain things, it may be helpful to bring someone from outside that culture in to help discuss the issue and realize that it's an issue of organizational life. It's not a competition between individuals for power.
Some of our character, and I'm one of those characters, have to compete. And competing for me makes it, I mean, I've got to make it the best. And I don't, in some ways, apologize for that because I believe my church and my God deserves the best. The other reality, becoming a CEO rather young in life, was how long it takes before you start seeing results of your work. And you become a CEO and you have dreams and aspirations for the organization, especially if you've been associated with it in a lesser role before. And suddenly you realize that for the first 3 years, in my organization anyway, that most of my time was spent dealing with problems of my predecessor. It wasn't until fourth or fifth year where I started dealing with problems of my own making. So the time horizon for a manager is out there, and it's got to be even further for a board. So you've heard some reiterations. What questions do you all have? We have one there.
Good Okay, I have a quick comment and then a question for Le Cooper, because I think it's very essential. You know, in Nigeria, there's something we call the federal character, where people, offices are chosen by where you come from. You know, that was the political structure. We have 6 geopolitical zones, so ministers have to come from the east, from the north, from the west, and things like that. And very soon, the national football team, the soccer team, was chosen by federal character. And of course, you know, when they went to play against Germany, there was no federal character in Germany, so Germany got the victory, because they did it by merit, not by where you came from. You know, it was so dramatic that when they came back home, people said that was a defeat waiting to happen. And it was a very good lesson. They had to disband the federal character and go by the merit character. I believe that it's about time that as a church, we also started, because it looks to me like the Seventh-day Adventist Church also works very much by the federal or the national character or by whatever character, so that we have so many different interests represented rather than expertise represented on the board. As long as that is, the larger the board, I have found from my own experience, I ended up with a board of 40 people. Yes. And when you have 40 people on the board, I can tell you, quality discussions are just not possible. Mm-hmm. Some will doze off. Others will, otherwise you just talk and talk about. And so we had to start thinning out. And effectively, when the board does not get to take very important decisions about the future, then the administration will be forced to do that, because the future will suddenly come, and then you'll be running back and forth. And then you have to choose what you want to be blamed for. Now, question is, is it by tradition, or is there something, because I heard Dr. Andresen saying that a board chooses, you know, maybe that's an industry, I don't know, in the public life. Is there something that is about the institutional boards, whether it's hospital or educational institutions, that says this is the way it must be, or also is it possible to have a dialogue when the board is composed, to have the dialogue with the owners of the institution to choose the board chairmanship on the basis of competence and experience rather than office, where somebody may just come in there who has never had any interaction, no interest even in an educational or healthcare institution, and is the president because he's a very good evangelist. He's a very good preacher, and he becomes president of the conference or the union or the division, and there he goes. And I think this is a good. Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Then somebody comes with the very next direct opposite. Oh yeah, I think we could do that. That's a good idea. And the management goes like a ping pong, ping pong. I believe that I would like to know how really did we, and how could we evolve policies to reflect the reality of the moment and the fact that Seventh-day Adventists are called to run the best institutions in the world, but we cannot do that with a good management without a competent board.
Let me say this, and then I'll let the panel speak also. Yeah. I knew a CEO who professed that what gave him the right to be the CEO was that he could do everyone's job in the organization. That is simply not the CEO's job. I cannot do the task of everyone who works for ARM. I don't have the skills they have. I have a different job that requires different skills. The same is true for a board chairman. I believe our chairmen need to be very skilled individuals, but they are not the manager of that institution. And I don't think that the chairman of the board of a hospital needs to be a doctor or even a hospital CEO, nor does the chairman of an educational institution need to be a professor or a president of a college. It's a different skill set that they need to succeed as a chairman, in my mind. Panel?
I guess my response is going to have two sides to it. First of all, with respect to typical denominational structure, the Constitution and bylaws will generally define how the board chair or the chair of the executive committee is chosen. Sometimes there is, some range of optionality in that. In the case of General Conference institutions, the Constitution and bylaws of General Conference institutions, I think without exception, indicate that the board selects the chair from individuals recommended by the General Conference president. I think that's the case. There may be even further specification that it shall be a General Conference vice president recommended by the General Conference president. And I think in most cases the General Conference president, at least the one we're working with now, has generally had some communication with institutional administration before making those recommendations. I'm not sure to the extent that he always has that liberty. The second side of my response is that, listen, if this is the structure we're living with, then we better make sure that we educate those people who are board chairs. And we better give training for that. I've done some training in the life of the church, and a question that I have frequently asked when I go to divisions and meet, generally with church leaders, how many of you have received training as to how to work in groups? Almost nobody puts up a hand. And yet the truth of our denominational structure is that our most important decisions are made in groups, in boards or executive committees. And yet we have people who have not been trained as to how groups work. And beyond that, we have people who have not been very well trained in how to lead groups. It's an important piece of education that I think is missing. When we have this process that you've described as being something where the leadership of the board is almost predetermined by our denominational linkage, I think we can remedy that, not by changing the system of selecting, but by changing how we address the education of people for that particular skill.
Could I perhaps amplify that from a sort of practical level? I agree entirely that we need to be training people to lead people in a fashion which, our church administrators, in a fashion which means that they are able to lead people and hear them and understand them and translate what is coming back from the constituency, in this case, what's coming back from the board members. If the board members are well selected, the role of the chair is simply to be able to act as a chairperson, not to be an expert. And, I think I hear criticisms of board chairmen which are about their knowledge of that particular industry, in my case, the hospital industry. My board chairman knows very little, actually, about the hospital industry, but he's an excellent chairman. Supported by a well-selected board, and it's a very functional situation. We're not perfect. Clearly, there are ways that we can do better, but that's part of the challenge, and that's what makes life interesting, that there are ways that we can do things better, and we can see those, and we can work towards those. So I'm not putting us up as a perfect example, but I think that training in how to chair a meeting and how to get the most out of a group of people that are there with a lot to contribute is something that we need to do more, I think, within the church. Not necessarily appoint people who are experts in that area.
My sense is, though I don't know too much about this, but my sense is that every institution belongs to someone. So if it's a state-owned university or government-owned university, the government or the state will want to have a say in who gets to be trustees. Oftentimes these can be political appointments. That's not exactly ideal either, perhaps, at least in some places. I live fairly close to some large publicly owned, state-owned universities, and they complain endlessly about how trustees are appointed and what they have on their mind when they serve as trustees of these big universities. So let's not complain too much about the fact that we are owned too by our church. It's a better owner, I think, than a government in many ways. So I'm not going there by way of a complaint. What I want to observe is an impression I have that in at least some places in our world church, institutions in the past historically have been viewed as departments of the church organization, a department of a conference or a union or a division or a general conference. And we can think of operating them the way we operate a department. That, I think, is where we should change, not the sense of ownership. I would keep that. The church is our owner and we serve it through our institutions. No question about that. But viewing institutions not as departments, but as institutions in service of the mission of the church concept would be more wholesome. And that would mean that we can appoint board members in a little different way than just representation from every entity in church leadership in that district. I think if we could just make that shift, we would discover that the board members would be selected more along the lines you point out, members who are needed to serve the board. And last night I was having a little social event with some friends in Switzerland, and a gentleman told me that he had just been asked to serve on a board. He's a businessman. And he was asked by the division president to serve on a board of a certain institution because you have, said the division president, certain expertise or abilities as a business person to help our institutions. Would you be willing to stand as a candidate for the board? That process, I think, I like pretty well because we get a collection of really competent people to serve on the board. And I think if you were to think of it that way, we would not lose the loyalty nor commitment of the institution to the church mission. We would just recognize that nowadays most of our institutions cannot be viewed as departments of the church. And that in a way ties us to the previous conversation. Institutions have to have different alliances. They work in different environments. Hospitals work in a healthcare environment. And they need to understand reimbursements and pay a base and all that stuff to make it go. Educational institutions work in educational environments, and we have our own network that we have to keep up in order to make sure our education is of high quality. That's what is emerging in the future or in the present or in the recent past in our church. And I would ask our church leaders and all of us to recognize that, and in return, we will reaffirm our commitment to serving the church with everything we've got.
Okay. Other questions? You had lots of questions when you made the presentation.
Can I make a comment? I often get asked, how can you possibly run a business within a church organization which is conservative and doesn't always understand the needs of a business because we are a business? My answer to that is, look, you know, that is indeed the case, that it's often the case, but there are a lot of pluses. No matter what environment you find yourself working in, if you're in a corporate environment, you're responsible to shareholders. Personally, I would much rather be responsible to a church organisation with which I share the same ideals. Mm-hmm. and where I know there are really good people working who may not always agree with me, but you know, because they are good people and because we share higher level ideals, we can sit down and discuss those things and come to some solution which I think embodying those higher ideals will often be a better solution. And I don't share their I have frustrations, but I don't share their concept that those frustrations are any different than the frustrations any CEO feels who's responsible to a board, who's responsible to someone else. Because those people can often judge you much more harshly than does the church. They may have less understanding. If you're a shareholder yourself, as I am, and you sometimes go to shareholder meetings, you'll have you're in the situation as I'm being a CEO. You have great sympathy for those people who are in that situation. One of our competitors, who had a very good CEO, and they were very good competitors. They still are. Run a good hospital. Part of a corporate entity, said to me, Leon, he said, I really wish that I had something that you have, which I don't have, and that is a commitment to a higher ideal, which is seen by your community as something that differentiates you from us. You know, let's not underestimate the value of the organisation to which we belong, even though it may create some frustrations for us at times. Let's not understand the value of being part of such an organisation and having a set of ideals that we can all, in the end, we can all agree on those ideals and higher principles and then work from that.
We should probably stop talking here. But another way to think about that is to go back to the title of this topic announced. It has the words checks and balances. These are useful words to think about when we talk about this matter. For example, who checks and who balances? The board in an institution at the base level is responsible for securing, through the institution's work, the public good. Right? I mean, that's the board members come from the public. Let's say it's a church public. All the parents who send their kids to school, or all the people who send patients to the hospital, living in the community or belonging to the church, whoever they are, but there's a public there who is being served. And the board members has the unique responsibility to secure the public good, because they come from the public and represent that public when they come to board through a process of governance. The institution, the administration, brings to the task the skills, the capacity, the services that management has pulled together by hiring a bunch of staff and setting up services and programs to help meet the needs of the public and protect the public good. So there's always this balance between what the institution has of resources to serve the public good and what the public is depending upon for its welfare, as it looks to the hospital or to the university. So you'd expect when the board and the administration come together, they will look at a single task from two different perspectives. What does the public really need, and how can we best serve it? And the administration should be able to answer the latter question, and the board should address the former. The president's task, in a way, is to listen to these two conversations and interpret the board's wishes and hopes and dreams to the institution and explain the institution's capacity or lack thereof to the board representing the public interest. So the president is always having a two-way conversation, trying to bring these two together, and when they're brought together, the institution is successful. Checks and balances.
Brother Wiley.
There seems to be a tension in counsel being given to us today by consultants. I was sitting in a board meeting recently where where the consultant said if you really want to be ready to meet the future, you should put number of non-Adventists on the board. And I believe there's a tension within academia and also even some health systems that believes that the boards need to be more proactive in being a little bit more following some of the popular best practices that's in the world today. And I heard yesterday in Dr. Andreasen's excellent presentation about the idea of boards choosing their own chairman. And I think that can be good in some situations, but the question I'd have for the committee is how do we avoid mission drift? When you look at Harvard, Yale, some of these great institutions of America, they were started by religious institutions, they were started by religious movements. How do we avoid, if we go down the road of allowing boards to choose chairs, if we go down the road of reducing, and I'm clergy, I'm many times referred to as one of the priests or bishops of the church because union presidents are, that's what people tell you, who are you, what do you do? And that, I don't refer that way, but that's how some describe our positions. But I serve on multiple boards in the North American Division, some GC institutions, and it is a challenge to try to keep up with all of the different boards and their particular focus, mission, trying to really be a responsible board member. But at the same time, I chair a board, the university board, the newest university board, I think, probably in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the president sitting next to me, Washington Adventist University, one of the finest, a little plug for that. But and I watch the conference presidents on that board, I used to be one, and I see their counsel, I hear their counsel. How do we protect if we go down the road of being in the area of best practice, how do we avoid mission drift in that accountability? I'd like to hear the panel discuss that in a moment.
Well,
just a couple of comments. Since you referenced an educational institution, in the case of Andrews University, the bylaws state that the board selects its president on the recommendation of a general conference president, and those bylaws were written by your predecessor, so they must be okay. Sorry about that. But that's what happens, and that's how we do it. That's how we practice it. Your second question was, what about members on the board who are not of our faith? I would come back to what Leon said. If our board members are Adventists who are connected to the public that we serve, to the community, I don't think there's merit in having Methodist or Baptist. I mean, we don't really define an effective board member just because he has a religion different from ours. The really important part is to have board members who are connected with the people who are looking to our institution for important services in health or education or what have you, who understand those needs, who understand the community, and can guide the institution to provide the kind of services that would be the greatest blessing to the community. These are the kind of board members we should have. Is there a handicap if they're all Adventists? No, I think that's an asset because we have a unique service, whether educational or health, that is defined by more than 100 years of history, and it has a lot of strength in it, and we don't want to dilute your strength. So I don't really think that's such a big issue that to go in that direction. I have never felt convinced that way because I think we have more and more members of our faith who are well-connected and well-informed about the work we do and the community we serve and how best to do it. By the way, mission drift, forgetting who we are. Yes, some institutions forgot, but some remembered. Every time in North America you speak about Harvard, Princeton, Yale that were religious ones, and they are not now, I will counter by saying Calvin, Hope, Oberlin, Rice, Notre Dame, Alma, Adrian, Madonna, all around Michigan, and they are all confirmed Christian-based institutions. Yes, some left, but many stayed, and Adventist institutions are amongst those who stay.
I think if you go back to the presentation I made about skill sets on the board, maybe that's what the consultants are trying to tell us. What are the consultants really trying to tell you when they say you got to have more than Adventist on the board? I'm an old-fashioned conservative guy. I think they ought to be Adventist. But when you have 8 conference presidents on your board, what do you got? You know, you got 8 conference presidents. You haven't created the diversity of skill sets or connectedness or insights that you would need on a smaller board anyway.
Well, I would certainly agree. I would have a very engaging conversation with a consultant who comes along and says, you need to have non-Adventists on your board. I think that is a totally artificial way of describing board composition. I think the issue is expertise. And I'm proud to say I think our church has a marvelous expertise. And the more you look, the deeper you find the pool of expertise in the church. And I think it is right that our Seventh-day Adventist institutions value that we treasure having Seventh-day Adventists who are competent to serve as trustees. It gets back to the point of distributing, comprising a board with the range of expertise that is necessary. I believe that it is important to have church representation on the board. Maybe we have overrepresented it and underrepresented other expertise sets that don't come just because you have been trained as a preacher and you've worked in church administration for a long period of time. But I also think that is an expertise that is certainly needed on the board. Certainly. And it needs to be valued, and I think in many ways it is valued.
No, I agree that it's an expertise and you need it on the board, but you also need other expertise.
Right. Yeah, look, I don't disagree with anything that's been said, but you mentioned the word tension. This is one of the areas of tension between, for example, a CEO of a business, let's call it an educational business or a hospital business, I was talking to the CEO of Sanitarium, which is a very large business the church owns in Australia. And we discussed this issue because it is an issue that comes up often. You know, where is the skill set? And I agree there is great depth within the church, and that usually it's possible to find the sort of expertise that you need within the church. But I think occasionally that's not the case. And I think there needs to be some potential where that expertise doesn't exist in the church to appoint people who understand who we are, what we're about, to our institutional boards. And that's where I have a little difference, I guess, with our owners. I'm willing to accept that they feel that that's a primary consideration. I'm willing to accept that, but it doesn't mean that I necessarily agree with it. I think the issue of mission drift is about intentionality by both the chairman of the board and the CEO that mission, Adventist mission, is paramount in terms of everything that we do. We do, in fact, have one non-Adventist on our board, and we frequently get questions at division meetings about that. You know, somebody says, have you got any non-Adventists on your board? Knowing that we have one, of course, they'll ask the question. And yes, we have the chairman of our medical advisory committee on our board as an appointee. But that I don't apologize for that. If we could have the chairman of our medical advisory committee an Adventist, that would be the ideal. But that we don't have a single Adventist who is an attending medical officer at our hospital, and we have 600 of them. We don't have a single Adventist who is committed to the hospital. And I don't know why that is. And I feel very sad and upset that that's the case. But, you know, there are situations like that. I give that example as a rather extreme one. where I think we need to be a little bit more flexible in our view about whether all members of the board of an institution need to be Adventist.
The flip side of that is, how come the owners aren't supporting the institution? That's a serious issue that has to be explored by the boards and management also, part of the task.
I mean, Kevin Jackson, who's the CEO of Sanitarium, has a real issue about that, and he accepts it the same as I do. I mean, it's one of the limitations, what we perceive as limitations, of the environment in which we work. And he's not here, so I'm not speaking behind his back. That's a very successful business. Sanitarium is a major business player in Australia and supports the church to the extent that 50% of the church's income comes from the Sanitarium Health Food Company. A tremendous advantage to the church in Australia.
Leon, one thing, you may not know this, but I worked with Kellogg's. Sanitarium Foods, about 10 years ago, had 11% of the world market in cereal business. Now, to have 11% of the world, and that came from Kellogg's. A friend of mine told me, the chairman told me at Kellogg's. And that is a significant international company then. It's not just an Australian company.
Yeah. No, I mean, Kellogg's, one of their main goals was to knock Weet-Bix off the top, year on year on year, was to knock Weet-Bix off the perch as the biggest selling cereal in Australia. They've now given up. It's not one of their. I know a guy who works for Sanitarium too. Said they've now taken it off. They've given up. It's a non-achievable goal.
I think Leon has asked a very fair question, or presented a very convincing statement that, you know, you have to look at the issue of expertise and competence. I don't think anyone is trying to say that the non-Adventist, Adventist fulcrum is the way we should determine governance. I think the appeal here is that, how do we get competence in governance and engagement with the communities and the realm of business that an organization deals with? For me, that's certainly the underlying question. Getting the right people on the board and having a board that is engaged in knowing mission and protecting that. Church membership alone does not create that qualification in its entirety.
You know, I said I'm an old-fashioned traditionalist, and I believe that our boards ought to be Seventh-day Adventist. On the other hand, I have five corporate boards. I have five corporations, GC entities that I manage, and two of them have non-Adventist board members to meet. They're there to meet very specific statutory requirements. And fulfill the skill set that the government requires for me for those organizations to exist. And I guess theologically my answer to that is the text that talks about no Smiths in Israel. But I think there are a lot of skilled Adventists, and we need to develop them and bring them in, and we need to look at skill sets when we fill our board slots. Ted, you had a question?
Yeah, I understand where Leon is coming with medical advisor, but typically within hospital structures internationally now, more and more, the medical staff is expected to be self-governing, and usually they vote their own leadership. And I think the institution, and we're reserving in our bylaws the right to approve potential officers for the medical staff, and the reason for that, Leon, is just simply, make sure your heart is with this hospital, not another one. And I think that's one of the things. And then if that happens to be a non-Adventist, you have to support the philosophy or you have to leave, very simply. And so I think you have that. The other thing is, I've served and I've chaired a number of boards outside of the church and in the community. And in a not-for-profit setting, the definition of getting on a board is by donations. One of my problems has been that in the Adventist boards, many times there are no donations. And the donations come from outside, much more than they do. And when that happens, and we had Milton Murray. He came to Penang, to Battle Creek years ago, and he set up a really blue ribbon foundation, which unfortunately died shortly after I left, with people from Whirlpool Corporation were on it, Kellogg's and different Upjohns. But the reality was again, donation. But this was a board set up strictly as a foundation to support the hospital services. In a British environment, it is now becoming somewhat normal in a hospital structure to develop what's called a board of visitors, which has to be community-based and usually is not religious-based. Now, that's going to present some interesting challenges for us. And I think we're going to have to figure out how to work with that, and not just us. All of the hospitals, for instance, in Malaysia, be they, and they're almost all for profit, are trying to figure out how to deal with that issue. But finally, I guess I would give a comment on Battle Creek years ago when I was president there. That hospital was basically closed almost when I arrived. And we had to turn it from med-surg to psych. The only way I could do it was I sat down with the top board member in town, the top banker in town, and got him to agree to serve on our board. He was Catholic, but he was a strong supporter. His family and his wife's family had supported that hospital from the days of Ellen White. And so at that point, we got his support. And frankly, he was the man that went to Kellogg's and Post and Whirlpool and got the support to recommit their patients to us. We could have never pulled that off. By the same token, the decision to take down the old Stone building, he personally went to Congress on three occasions at his own expense to plead the case of them picking that up like they had the building the government now has, the old original hospital from 1902, and that was rejected. So sometimes these people that don't carry an Adventist mantle have an ability inside the community to communicate for you far better than you do, and it looks much more honest and independent.
One comment, and then I'd like Dr. Andreasen to comment. Sometimes ownership is not defined as brightly, with a bright line as we wish. You talk about the banker. He may not have been an owner, but he had a substantial financial investment, and he wanted to protect that investment. When you looked at your balance sheet, maybe it wasn't so untrue. Sometimes where the money comes from does, even though it's not equity, does control some of those things. Dr. Andreasen, perhaps you'd like to respond about the donations and the board membership connect, particularly in education. Maybe not.
Well, I serve on some boards. Actually, I serve on a local hospital board, and I do make a donation because to that hospital, one that is appropriate for my level of income. It's not huge, but I do it because it is expected that all board members will contribute to health care in our region, and board members should show a good example by doing that. What about our church institutions? I can tell you what happens at Andrews University. About half our board members are ex officio. They are served by virtue of holding office, some office in the church, and they are not inclined to make contributions because of their board membership, and for good reasons. These ex officio board members serve on so many boards, they would have no money left if they had to give to all of them, scores of boards in some cases. However, the importance of making a contribution to the welfare of the institution on whose board one serves is recognized, I believe, by the church headquarters, because it sends us an annual check with a combined contribution and all the names of those trustees who contributed to the calculation. It's in some ways a token amount, but still a welcome contribution to the university. Board members who are appointed, elected, not ex officio board members at Andrews, are being visited to make their contribution, but no fixed amount is set. We feel that if you invest a little bit in institution, you will also spend more time being ready for board meetings, and you will care more about the success of the institution, and so we do that. In addition, I don't know if that's helpful, but a few years ago, we established a group of friends of the university. All of them are, well, put it differently, none of them are employed by the church. They have their own employment. And the board agreed to appoint this group of persons as a subcommittee of the board charged with institutional development. And that works. It functions. It has a kind of a rotating membership, but it does function. And support from that group has been significant. Very, very large level of support, actually, from that group. And they, I would say, are pretty proud, most of them, of their involvement with the university. They meet twice a year. A month before the board meeting, they make their contributions and commitments and make recommendations for the development of the institution, scholarships for students or buildings for teachers and whatever needs to be done. Universities and hospitals, at least where we live, and I think it's true in Europe, have to be inspected and accredited by agencies, public or independent agencies. The Joint Commission in the United States, and I think in your hospital also, Ted, inspects and approves the operations. Okay, so that's a kind of an external agency. Well, we have one at Andrews University too, and I met with them not so long ago. And they ask more questions about governance at Andrews University than have come up in our discussion here. They're keenly interested in that because they know that good governance makes for good institutions, and that's why we should pay attention to it, and we have sort of talked for a long time. We should, and we should talk in a more focused way and actually draw up some recommendations on just that topic of governance, because it's so important. So these inspectors or visitors came to campus and they wanted to know about governance and about the board. And they had a complaint. And the complaint was that they felt that the board had a lot of ex officio members on it who gave no evidence that they represented a public. I think, in a way, these ex officio board members do represent the public, but it was not obvious because you couldn't put your hands on the public. One came from California and three from Washington and one from here and there, and it was an odd sort of a public to try to identify. So I got knocked a little bit in the head because of that. Then, to help out, I described this subcommittee of the board of all invited elected members. And when they heard who they were and what they cared about, they said immediately to me, now we see a group of people representing an identifiable public, and they are expressing commitment to the university, so you have sort of remedied the situation and answered the question in a different way. And the inspection went on very nicely. If this is helpful for other institutions, whether medical or educational, we've done it, and it has been a benefit to Andrews University, and it took maybe 3-4 years to make this group melt together. It took a lot of effort, but it has now happened, and I'm personally very pleased with it and would be glad to recommend it to others.
We have just about 3 minutes. Do you have any concluding remarks, panel members?
I,
I guess come back to the point that I think we need to find in our organizational structure and in our administrative leadership more time to focus on the educational elements of governance. I hear Dr. Andreasen's statement about, you know, putting forth some specific recommendations. I think that would have been a very helpful exercise for us to work on. But even in the absence of that, I think the presentations and the discussions we've had have isolated some areas where we recognize there is a need in the church. And we are the ones who can give some response to that. It doesn't need to take an act of the executive committee, although that might in some cases be a little bit helpful. But that shouldn't be the only stimulus that we rely on to address these kinds of things.
Thank you. Anyone else? Leon?
Look, I can't do anything else except agree and emphasize those points that, you know, if we've done nothing else today, but I guess concentrate and emphasize the importance of good governance to the success of any organization, be it a church institution or be it the church itself and the elements of the church, then I think we've achieved something. But beyond that, some recommendations and some formal education of people associated with boards, I think would be a great thing.
Okay. Thank you, panel.